Welcome to the Entrepreneur's Logbook Podcast, where we uncover the strategies and insights behind extraordinary business growth. Today, we're joined by Michal, founder of Rally Cal Get to Marketing, a brand development consultancy, storytelling consultancy company in crafting compelling narratives and building strategic brand positioning for high growth companies. Throughout his career, Michal has helped companies raise over $650 million in venture capital and has helped his client achieve exits exceeding over $4 billion to companies such as Google, Dell, Intel, and eBay. And as a brand veteran strategist, he's also behind some of the biggest success stories, one a lot of people might have heard of, which was growing Waze to 100 million users before its $1.1 billion acquisition by Google, and then also orchestrating Moveit's pre-acquisition rebrand before it was acquired by Intel. Michal, it's great to have you on the show.
Hey, thank you so much. I always appreciate the time to talk about myself at large at length. if that's any opportunity.
Of course. Cool. I think probably the best way to start this, kick things off, would be to get a bit of background around yourself. Because as you mentioned, a lot of people know you for obviously Waze, obviously growing pretty heavily. But a lot of people don't know the rest of your background, what you're doing right now, and that's where I would love to touch on as well.
Sure. I appreciate you bringing up the Waze. It's funny you should mention that because it was, I was identified once at LAX and once in Tel Aviv as the Waze guy, because I was the young guy that had to be the face of the company, because nobody else really wanted to be. And so it definitely was part of my shaping who I was, who I am. But more recently, things like Be Hero, which is on Time Magazine's Inventions of the Year this year, which was really exciting to see, the work of my founders, but also the work that we've done collaboratively kind of get to where it is.
And you've had a lot of background in marketing and communication at a lot of companies. And then obviously with your company, you've taken all that experience and then applied it to work with the current clients you're working on. But I guess I'd be curious, from the beginning, your journey, how you even got into the space. And a lot of people decide to go into marketing, but they don't go as successful that you've had. Not to be too self-promotional in that way, but.
Oh no! I mean, if you saw my grades and my high school grades, graduated with a 2.3, you have to try really hard to do that. I went into marketing because I really didn't know what else to go into. I went to communications because that was the one thing I knew I could do without trying too hard. I come from a family of linguists. My mom speaks 18 languages. My dad speaks 12. So having a grasp on English was the only thing I really had going for me. It really wasn't anything else. And so I really started in PR at the first PR agency that was dedicated to apps called VSC. And we launched App Launch PR was the name of the agency. And I did some launches like the virtual Zippo lighter. If you remember that app, one of those early ones that was just literally a Zippo lighter on the phone.
I think I know.
Yeah. I mean, hundreds of millions of downloads. It was just a free promotional thing. But, artists were using it at concerts or videos of Maroon 5, putting it on stage. I got to work on some really silly things because those were the early days of mobile. There were a lot of experiments. I worked on the Kraft macaroni and cheese recipe app. I worked on the Gap, send us a picture of your child for our photo app. I worked on, we had a helicopter game app that we successfully got Smokey the Bear to co-opt the branding for. And I got to do a bunch of PR for a bunch of rappers and remix albums, like 50 Cent's Rompler remix album. It was wild days, early days of mobile, and anything seemed possible. And so when I'd been doing a lot of PR and in that sense, also doing branding because, early stage PR it's not about having the best technology necessarily. It's, you need to have a really powerful narrative too. That's certainly part of what I've been focusing on in my work. It's really that a story can really transform a trajectory of a company, and making that narrative, fit for your users, for your investors, for really society at large to accept your technology, which we're sort of in an age now where tech is synonymous with our everyday life. It's no longer just it's part and parcel of everything. So, that's really where I've had the opportunity to to help a bunch of early stage founders try and tell the world or show the world something that they can do that hasn't been done before. And so I had a couple of years at VSC, and I had some clients exit to, I was doing with Wise, which was had Pocket Cloud, which was a companion app to sort of let you remotely control computers earlier in the day. And all of a sudden this mapping company came up called Waze, and no one had ever heard of it in the United States. It wasn't a big deal. And other countries had started up. That was kind of what the magic of that app partially was, the community really built it. And the United States was not the first market that we went into. It was obviously the most important market and the one that defined it later on. But, there were countries like Costa Rica that had built the maps themselves entirely without any help, without any aid. And, they had people functioning mobile map of the country that nobody else had at that time. Google Maps was just getting to that game, but it wasn't provided as broadly. It seemed like a ridiculous proposition, really, to save you time. I remember that was a big decision I left, because I was actually working, I was with a girlfriend of mine across the table. I was sort of senior at the agency. I figured if this was a time to go and take a role at a startup, this is what I was going to do. But there was a lot on the line. I was giving up a lot. What turned out to be total 2-hour commute the end both ways for many years. But it was a chance to jump on something that hadn't been done before. And I really didn't believe that it could save you time. It seemed a little too impossible to be real. And so I drove down, and find that the company was actually headquartered, the US headquarters were in Palo Alto, which is where I grew up. In fact, our actual headquarters as an office was a Radio Shack that I used to go to with my grandfather growing up as a kid. So this is a little surreal, literally across the street from City Hall in Palo Alto. Very, very strange, but we were one of the only apps that had a storefront. There really weren't many. And you can imagine how many people wanted customer service for a free app when there's a storefront. And this is the early days of apps, because no one really knew what customer service was for an app. I mean, my phone number was the only phone number attached to any press release, my personal phone number. I had to change it several times because the Waze community won, and I just could not keep being civil. I could be the civil when they came to the door and said, "Of course, we'll help you with your app." I could. It was hard when I was getting calls all the time. But yeah, that was my big leap into doing it all on my own, without sort of any. I was the agency of record for Waze, and my first couple of days, the CEO Noam, turned out to be a mentor of mine. He said, there's three things I want from you. I want a tagline. I want to meet Steve Jobs, and I want to meet Walt Mossberg. I was like, okay. I mean, Walt Mossberg. I am training. I know how to do this. I have done it. You want to meet him, Walt Mossberg? Okay. I can do that. I can do that. I will figure out how to do that. And a tagline. You know what? Give me a couple days, a couple showers. I will come up with something. Steve Jobs. That's a whole nother matter. Although Steve Jobs would go on one day to tell people to use Waze instead of Google Maps or instead of Apple Maps when it wasn't good enough. And that was a big day, because NPR called me and they said, "Did you know that Steve Jobs told everybody to use Apple Maps?" And he said, "No, no, but it is my birthday and I'm at home and this is news to me." So really it was really the startup journey that I could have only dreamed about. I did not have the grades either in college or high school to do anything like that. So it was a combination of good luck and surrounding myself with the right people. Certainly the people around me I'm just a reflection of them, because the opportunities that I've been given and the people that I've worked alongside and the things that I've seen them make, just every day astonishes me.
That's interesting, because you've been somewhat labeled as like the ways guys, as you mentioned, like people randomly like the airport and stuff like that. But you've also had the chance of working on like campaigns for like artists, like music artists and stuff like that, which when you think about it, like your main focus like at the moment is more brand oriented, like companies. But you've had like that dual focus of being able to focus on like those like personal brand as well, if I'm not like totally mistaken in like a way. And then you have like more the company focus. And like when you look at Waze, would you say that was somewhat your like introduction, like serious introduction to like the world of like branding, like marketing as a whole, that somewhat really like propels you like out there?
Oh yeah. I mean, I had to learn how to do everything. I mean, there was the tagline. I had to learn how to do App Store copy. I had to learn to do App Store copy optimization back in the day. Like how many times do I have to use the word fuel in App Store to make it, to get it, you know, to get it profiled or featured. I had to learn how to do TV broadcasts, news. I had to learn how to pitch broadcast TV. I had to learn, how to do billboards. I had to learn how to respond to inbound pitches from, you know, a bunch of agencies and companies that promised you the world. But really you could end up doing it yourself if you just, you know, figured it out. And so, yeah, that was sort of my beginning into everything. And, you know, then the Google acquisition happened. And you know, I grew up in the Bay Area, so I knew what it was like, what Google was like. I had seen the campus. I had friends that had interned there. It wasn't exactly what I wanted to do. So while it was vindicating, and you know, it really set me up to start taking on clients and taking on different projects. It really was, you know, it taught me also that writing an email to a journalist is not as hard, or you know, sort of similar to writing to an email to, you know, a nonprofit if you're trying to pitch some help for them too. Or as I, you know, learned that I pitched the mayor's office of San Francisco of Civic Innovation on helping them with their entrepreneur residence program, and I got to help with that. I got to help with TEDx, you know, shows around the city because I learned how to effectively communicate, and you know, if not my value proposition, at least what I thought was worthy of their attention. And that has really been a blessing. And I would say the only, you know, that's the skill set that I have.
Yeah. But one thing I found like really interesting is you mentioned like you obviously went to high school. You didn't have like the best GPA in like a way, but you were still able obviously to work with like major companies, Waze, Exit, and stuff like that. So I feel like oftentimes we see this correlation where you go to like university, you get like a degree or anything like that, and then you get thrown into like the real world. You haven't done this before. They're not training you how to pitch journalists or anything like that. You somewhat have to do it yourself first to be able how to do it in like the first place. Like you never wrote like all those ad copies and like the like optimizing like headlines and like the App Store and stuff like that. But you had to. Like you had to learn how to do these things. And I feel that as you get like this more experience, you learn these new things. That's where like some of how your career is built, as opposed to just learning it with your like your 2.3 GPA. But I think that's interesting. And one of like the other things that I'd really be curious about is you've obviously been behind some like a lot of like acquisition with like companies you've worked with that they've gone like acquired. And a lot of it, and correct me if I'm wrong here, comes down to also like how a company positions themselves, perhaps like how they present themselves, like VCs, angel investors, etc. When you started like working with like any company, or perhaps when a company comes to you for like help, they want to like acquire funding, they want to like exit, like what kind of strategy do you like approach it with as far as perhaps rebranding or just like optimizing like their current branding to perhaps like maximize like their valuation or like interest by like VCs, if that makes sense?
No. I mean, that's, you know, you kind of outlined the steps that it takes anyway, really. You know, it's not really just kind of understanding who you are, but really understanding who you could be, you know, in the eyes of a potential acquirer. And I have been approached by companies shortly before an acquisition to rebrand them to make sure that they are, you know, highly visible before that acquisition. And that usually means kind of reinventing their entire language. But you know, it really starts sitting at the intersection really of your current value and your future potential, really, and like what you could possibly be. And so you really have to start with like clarifying the unique, you know, value proposition first, and what is yours, and also what are those of your potential acquirer. You know, at this stage, yeah, you've come this far and you're looking for some sort of some sort of action to be taken, then you need to start aligning yourself more closely with what they do. And so really, it's seeing what your potential acquirer's goals are, and then really aligning a story around scalability and really around market leadership that makes you, you know, not just where you are, but really where you're going. And that makes sure that the narrative really resonates with your customers, but your future, you know, strategic investors too, because they want to see that you are starting to mirror some of the things that Google is saying. You know, they want to make sure that even if they are not the ones acquiring you, they want to see that you are getting yourself ready for that. Really, the goal is kind of to make it feel less like a transaction and more like a natural step for the company. And so it really starts with figuring out, you know, where do you want to be, not so much who you are right now. And that's sort of the approach that we take.
So essentially like being able to convey like your value proposition in like a very understandable way that first obviously explains that value proposition to you, but someone explains the benefit of potential like investors, like based on like their vision, mission. I mean, it could literally be another company that's trying to acquire this company, make like a merger or anything like that, and use like their current resources, market share they have, etc. But it's about effectively being able to position yourself so you actually appeal to those people, but also being able to convey where you're trying to go in like those next few years, your vision, so people understand, hey, this company is here for like the long run. Like they're not just trying to exit and then that's it in like a year times, which some tech companies are. They're just trying to go for the exit, which I mean, it's fine, but...
Yeah. That's fine. Listen, there's glory in all shapes and sizes. Not to judge anybody's, because I also have been on the other side of that, where you're sort of thinking, well, nothing is going to happen, and that can be, you know, a little soul crushing, because you're expecting something to happen in the startup world. You sort of are. You're expecting, you know, I definitely have a chapter or two in failory.com for companies that I've helped that, you know. That's just how it is. And you need to wear that as a badge of honor here in Silicon Valley. You need to know that, like, you know, even your best efforts, not everything's gonna take or hold. But that's always the hope and the expectation, certainly.
Yeah. And you mentioned like earlier, you had like a company come to you, like when they're just like going, like they're trying to like do their acquisition, like exit, like really like a short time window, I'm assuming. Do you typically have like a recommendation, like how long it takes to usually like start like rebranding the company? Because I'm assuming if a company tells you like, hey, we're trying to get started with this process in like 2 weeks, it's probably not going to work out. Like there is like a lot of more due diligence.
Thank you for asking that, because the answer is it really depends on budgets. You know, as a freelancer, I would like this project to take as long as it needs to take, for every reason. For fiscal reasons, but for creatively, the fewer parameters and walls you have on your thinking, the better, regardless. But you know, you also need to have some structure too, because there's, you know, without having anything. And so it really depends on kind of what aspect of that rebrand or the launch you're trying to do. You know, if you're trying to do, I would say just, let's say a new tagline and name for the company, and sort of the collateral that associated with that, you know, I usually say that takes some, you know, 3 to 6 months if you have a time to have a whole team that's going to do and implement everything too. There's a big difference between strategizing the stuff and implementing it, because I have a bunch of vendors that I work with too who help with that, but the startups themselves like to do it in-house, and as they should, because they really want it to be in their branding. Lost my train of thought there, sorry.
Yeah, good. No, that makes sense. So it's really more so based on
It's based on what they're willing to. They're also what they're willing to budget for you. You know, because you know, and there are things that you just can't take. To your point, you know, I there are projects that, you know, they want something overnight, and that's just not going to happen. It's terrible for me, because I'm not one to necessarily turn down business. But second, you have to consistently and continually remember, you know, what you need to be successful in what you do, because it's very easy to start leaning into what you're seeing the clients are wanting or clients are asking for, And people always want things faster and for less money. And that's never going to change, right? That's going to stick. So you have to be able to roll with that. And you have to be able to say, listen, I'm not going to take this project. You know, you can offer me as much equity as you want, but I can't take this project because I need to, you know, I need to know that I'm working towards something. But at that same point, I also, you know, I divide my services and I say, listen, we can also have a starting budget for, you know, this is what the project will be. And a lot of times I come on as an advisor to the company and take equity in the company. And that way, one, they kind of get to have, they can have my tone of voice consistently for whenever they need it. But two, it helps me have skin in the game and it helps me want to be participating in something because there is, you know, I'm not different than anybody else. I'm a startup person. I want there to be something happening, you know? And it's not always the pursuit of that, but it's something that is a reality of when you live in the Bay Area and you work in tech and there are a lot of dreamers out there. But you need to get paid. So yeah, I think it's really about balancing, you know, what you think you should do, what you know you need to do with, you know, what circumstances you're under.
But I like the way that you framed it, that sometimes like you have to set the expectations that what you're expecting, is it possible? Sure. Is it worth doing that you're actually going to get a quality product and it's actually going to have a good impact? Probably not. And I feel you need to set these boundaries with like potential clients and clients to say like, hey, based on my experience, if we follow what you want to do, this is not going to work out. If we take this timeline instead, then this can work out. And I feel like a lot of clients, like you'll have these clients that hire you for your expertise, which are the exact clients you want to work with. And you have the other ones that will try to tell you exactly what they want. But based on your expertise, you know that's not going to work out. You know exactly what is going to work and what is not going to work. And the clients that listen are the good clients. The ones that don't, those are typically the ones that you want to avoid working with. But no, and I know you've obviously been known as like the ways guy and like away, but another story and like another company which I thought was pretty interesting is you worked with like Be Hero, and you've actually grown that company pretty heavily because like a lot of people are probably not familiar with like the pollinator, like if I'm pronouncing that correctly, pollinator like space and like away, and there's even like a platform for that, and I think in like what was it like 18 months, I'm not getting that like incorrectly, you've built the platform to being just like a normal company up to being literally the largest platform in like the pollinator space, which is not a small achievement.
No, but I'm not going to take credit for that because I am neither an engineer nor a bee, but I am a big advocate for them, certainly. And we have to be as a species and a community very collectively happy that they're doing so well. not because we helped build the brand, but because 75% of the food that we eat is pollinated by bees. And a lot of people don't know that. There's most things about beekeeping are pretty shrouded. If you're not in the beekeeping industry, if your grandfather wasn't a beekeeper, it's hard to break into that. And that's because it's a very siloed, very, you know, there are rituals and behaviors and things that they follow that we have no idea about. And that was part of the hard part of growing this company was, you know, we really had to bifurcate our audience, one, to farmers. And that's already an audience of people a little distrustful of tech. And then beekeepers, which is a whole cast of people that just, we don't even know anything about. How do you market to beekeepers? You know, that is a, that was the question of the year. And the answer was, the same way you market to anybody else, with precision, and with, you know, with insight and not just, and learning a lot of the ways, you know, there are a lot of things that we did at Beehive that didn't work out, but there were a lot of things that did. You know, we were trying to. So California is a big region for almond growers in the world, and a huge percent of the almonds come from the United States and California. And a lot of those almond companies, the farmers and they are stationed here in California. But not necessarily here in San Francisco, not necessarily in the metropolitan areas, but kind of further down inland. And you know, how do we get in touch with those people? Because they're not reading TechCrunch, not reading Time at that point. You know, there's only so many people who are going to watch the Sacramento Morning News that aren't in Sacramento, and you know, we didn't have any door to door options at that point, or any kind of face to face options, because this is really during the pandemic too. I mean, this company grew to what it was during the pandemic, so we really didn't even have, you know, the opportunity of bringing Jell-O molds to our neighbors and saying, hey, have you heard of this thing called B-Hero? It's really going to increase your crop yield. But that was really a fantastic journey for me as a marketer to have to look at what I know how to do and say, okay, I need a whole new skill set.
Completely different.
Completely different. I mean, I had never done anything like it. And, you know, marketing for B-Hero was about micro communities. Certainly there are Facebook groups for farmers, there are Facebook groups for beekeepers. One of our most compelling marketing initiatives for B-Hero was a giant billboard that we put along specific trucking routes that we knew a lot of those farmers frequented, that said, better hives grow better nuts. And that was about the last thing the FCC, the first and last thing the FCC let us get away with on that. But but it worked, and that got the attention of a bunch of big farms near us, and actually UC Davis too, which is the, you know, premier institution in the States, at least for studying behavior and no pun intended, bee behavior, and really helped lead us into, you know, partnerships and negotiations with the USDA and really teaching the world that beekeeping is essential, that it's sort of not just the whales of the sky that we want to save because they're majestic creatures and they're lovely. I mean, they are magic creatures, but bees literally make our food, and we absolutely rely on them. And we don't have a swarm of government issued nano robotic pollinators yet. And not looking to anytime soon. So we really rely on them. And that was a story that was really about not positioning them as like this pollination company, because no one knows what pollination is. You know, my tagline, pollinate and prosper. Don't get me wrong. It works for what it is and for the audience, but you know, to somebody who doesn't know what pollination is, you have no idea. And really, we had a position really as a player in global food security. I mean, really that's what the big deal was here. It was taking really, you know, intense and complex agricultural tech and simplifying it, and not only convincing people that it works, but convincing people to put their livelihood on the line for it. You know, Bee Hero actually tells farmers literally how many bees are coming in and out of the hives every single day. That's insight they've never had before. They can actually figure out how much crop yield they're going to have based on how many bees. It's literally, you know, it's a numbers game. And Bee Hero tracks a bunch of other metrics besides bee health and the weather and all of statistics that kind of affect pollination. But that was really the immediate magic, was like showing the impact that this could have. It was literally visible in their crop yields. You know, the next season we could prove, hey, this isn't something that we're just telling you works, but you can actually see in the amount of money that you are pulling in, and not just the money that you're making, but the one that you can project to make. And for, you know, for agriculture, it's a really big deal too. They really need to plan way ahead for things. And so, yeah, you know, Bee Hero was a great example of like a, you know, how really like a straightforward mission really can appeal to a bunch of different stakeholders. Because the second part of that, pollinate and prosper, you know, I chose that prosper because prosperity is a word that we really see, you know, mostly evangelized and kind of in books of, you know, doing wealth and great prosperity. And honestly, there's a big bisection of the agriculture farmers and, you know, and those who go to church and read that book. And so, you know, it wasn't meant to be sneaky marketing. It was just meant to fulfill a promise that, you know, not a lot of people not other people were doing besides us.
Yeah. And it's like a really like niche industry, because like I looked at it, like I looked at the work you did with them. I was like, that's like the first time I've even heard of companies doing like this, something like this, and analyzing like the number of bees that go in and out. like, I know we're advanced in like tech, but I didn't really think that you could do this with like bees and stuff like that. But I think that's like really interesting. And what I thought was like really like unique is you mentioned like you really had to like simplify the marketing. So like in this industry specifically, like you're talking like agriculture, like technical terms, etc. But you're trying to appeal to like farmers, like beekeepers and stuff like that. So you really have to like simplify it so they understand like their own language. They see the value behind it and they're not like turned off by it in like any way. I feel that probably was like a pretty challenging thing to do, to like be able to do that. Because you worked with like other companies. It was probably really, as you mentioned, like really different from like what
you used to do. You know, it was a new market. But the thing, the fascinating thing about that is that like, you know, like any audience, Michael, like once you figure out the sweet spot, once you really understand what they want to be. And you know what I learned in my time, the beekeepers are interested in doing outside of being beekeepers, is space and NASA. And that really was a learning that we use throughout the entire product. Cause all of a sudden, you know, our beacons were transmitters. And you know, we had all the language that we used was based on sort of early NASA terminology that I knew from, you know, Apollo movies. And that turned out to be really what they cared about. There was, you make this sound like a technology that they're already familiar with, you know, that they already find inspiring. Space, it's always been the next frontier. And then everyone is fascinated by that. So we really appeal to that common thread that everybody has for that. And you can't really think about space and not think about how small you are, no matter how tall you are, you can't. And so it was fun figuring out that, you know, you can find one single sort of, it's an idea really more than anything else, sort of mm-hmm. space exploration and really imbue that into the product. And it really worked. And yeah, like you said, 18 months later, largest global pollinator in the world. I mean, hundreds of thousands of hives. I've checked the numbers recently, but they've raised 67 million and they're on their way to, I would not be surprised if they are, you know, a company that's on everybody's mouth eventually. Because it's just a matter of time. It's a matter of time because we're running out of resources and we are going to need technology that does less B2B SaaS enterprise solutions and more things that put food in my mouth or, you know, somehow restore this planet to what it was, because those are the really only two things that are going to matter in the next few years.
Yeah, I think there's going to be like a bit more like awareness around like the entire concept of like bees, and then that's where like companies like BeeHero are obviously going to be striving and are going to grow even like faster, maybe raise some more capital, or they might not even need to raise the capital with like the influx of interest. And I guess like one other thing, because we somewhat spoke onto like the concept of like tech with obviously like BeeHero, but another thing that you've obviously seen, you're in marketing, tech, branding, like AI, like it's talked like so much about it. It's changing like every single day. And I guess like one thing I'd really be curious about is where you see brands like really heading when we're considering like AI into the mix, like AI agents and like all that fun stuff. Because I know a lot of brands, for example, are using like AI to create like creatives, for example, like AI generated creatives. And you're like, this is real, like this is AI, like you can't even tell. And yeah. I guess I'd really be curious to where you potentially see brands heading, how branding might potentially change with that.
Yeah, I mean, this is a stressful time for marketers, and not just when it first came out. We're like, oh, well, that's my work as a copywriter gone. But then all of a sudden, as well, that's that graphic design work I could do on the side, or that's that stuff I could do on the side. That, you know, and so really, more than ever, cutting through the noise is really the most important thing you can do. I mean, there's so much garbage out there, and really, like, if you're real and you're authentic, and you're specific, you know, then you'll be able to actually interact with people in a way that's they're gonna trust you and believe what you have to say. I mean, it's also, you know, it's one thing to create make some creatives, but it's another thing to have that go on and build into a long-term brand. You know, the opportunities are out there certainly for marketers to prove themselves more than ever. I think that in general, you know, users are figuring out that they want to belong to something bigger. You can see that in TikTok. You know, there's a whole bunch of so many people feel for that brand and that product, and it's because it delivers an authenticity to people, because it allows them to deliver. You know, this is it's very obvious usually when people are making something on there. It's, you know, or they admit to it, right? There's an honesty about TikTok that people really like, and so I think that's the opportunity that marketers have now, is to keep that sense of credibility, that sense of authenticity, because
that's where it was going. Cause I feel there's going to be like a big shift where like authenticity is going to be like really big in like the next few years, where we might even see like a lot of brands that might be more like company centric and have it more focused on like the leadership, the founders just have more like that personal touch. And I feel with AI, like that's going to be really crucial, because people are not going to know what to trust and what to believe in. But if you have like a normal person, it's a bit more like relatable in like a way.
No. I mean, absolutely. That's, and as long as people are real people, you know, and not created by AI too. But you know, every time a new tech comes to market, I'm a tech determinist anyway. I think that society is always kind of decided by the tech that exists at that time and what's available to people. And every time something new comes along and is scary for everybody else, we adapt. You know, we adapt and we specialize. And so really specialization, I think, is important as a marketer, kind of going through this. I mean, for me, I really had to get into what I deliver is go to market, get to marketing. Anybody can go to market. I get you to market. You know, that's what I helped do. And that was sort of a niche that helped me and you know, helped me offer something that AI wasn't going to replace, which was a lot of experience in launching products, in launching brands, and in dealing with the repercussions of all that, you know, that programs can certainly, and AI can certainly try and predict, but the reality is it doesn't have the same experience. So specialize. That's really what I would say is the best way to keep yourself relevant, and the best way to make sure that you don't get replaced by something, you know, on a subscription basis.
Yeah, I agree. And I think like one of the last things I'd be curious about is, you've obviously worked with like clients, like a lot of them that had like exits, and you've obviously had like this communication background where you've pitched people, like journalists, nonprofits, like the mayor, as you mentioned, like San Francisco. One of the things I'd be curious about is, you've obviously seen like a lot of like these founders trying to tell their stories to like VCs, angel investors, trying to like pitch like their company. Is there like any specific things that you notice like a lot of them do that completely like hurts your chance of even getting funding in like the first place? Like I'm seeing you laugh right now, and I can tell there's probably a few.
No, I mean, I wouldn't say that there, you know, there's any one thing, but I will say that there, you know, the thing that I've seen repeatedly and that I kind of have to warn founders about first is just not getting lost in the weeds of your own tech, because it's very easy to focus on the features and things that they've worked really hard. You spent night and day. You haven't done anything but work on this. But if you're not really focusing on what that enables, like what transformation is your tech actually doing for people, and that hurts, because it's like telling an artist that some part of their art is not as important as the rest of it, and you're saying actually it's all part of it. But you know, art is there is an art to fundraising too, you know, and you have to, they certainly have to know how to make that value clear without making it, you know, completely dependent on features in their product. It's, you know, it's about painting like a, you know, the future that you're trying, that you want people to live in. It's really not like, you know, what is this, or how it is this, why do we exist? Why is this, why are we who we are right now? And once you can actually talk about that, you're not really selling a product anymore. You're selling the next step of whatever you, you know, that future that you're promising, that's what you're promising the world. And so I think that trying to always, you know, get specific about features of the product or things that it can do, not as important as what we will be able to do once our problems are solved by this technology. So that would be the one for sure.
Because I've seen so many like technical like founders, co-founders like emphasize on just creating new features and marketing those features, when like a lot of these users literally just want like one simple feature that is like what delivers like most of the results. Sometimes you have to focus on what actually drives the value, as opposed to having like these fancy little things. And I said sometimes. I would say
listen. The best pitches, the ones that really tie in, you know, larger market trends and like human needs. You know, those are the ones that really get the attention. Not, you know, how is this going to solve a problem for a very small fraction of a small part of your business? It's just not exciting. So it happens. You're right. It happens. But I would say, in the early stage funding and early stage brand development, you have to be more flexible.
Love it. No, well, I really appreciate you coming on the show. This is actually a really great conversation here. And if anyone wants to like reach out to you, get in touch with you, I know your phone number was on like a lot of press releases, you've been spam before, but is there like any best platform that people should look at to reach you?
Yeah, sure. My website, rallycall.co. That's my get to market agency. All LinkedIn is the easiest way to do it too. Since the name is completely unpronounceable, they'll have to look it up how to spell it. But I'm happy to, I'm happy to hear from anybody that wants to reach out for insight or anything else I can offer. Thanks for your time. I really appreciate having a chance to talk about all this stuff.
No, this is really great. Thank you so much.